knowing what's the rest. Life is but a dream. Where's the boat going? It's just a dream. Just a row, row, rowing boat. Gently down the stream. Where are you going? Nobody knows. Just a rowing boat. Just had experiences. One after the next. Or a more sophisticated example of the same thing. It's the same thing. Just the package and the ribbon is different. It's the same thing. You can read in Science of Self-Realization, where Shiva is having a discussion with Professor Durkheim, Indology professor, very in Germany, well-known professor. And in the discussion, Professor Durkheim was holding the position, together with students, he was holding the position that said, knowledge for knowledge's sake. Prabhupada was saying, what is the purpose of the knowledge you're presenting, the purpose of this whole university institution here in Germany? You get which university. And Professor Durkheim's reply was, knowledge for knowledge's sake. And Prabhupada's reply was ridiculous. Knowledge has to be applied. And Durkheim would say, knowledge for knowledge's sake. You don't have to apply it. Just knowledge for knowledge's sake. Prabhupada was patient up to a point, and it went around about four times, and then Prabhupada took a sledgehammer out and smashed it. Knowledge for knowledge's sake. So rather than going into the detail of that dialogue, there's a purpose, whether it's education or whether it's family or choosing your career, living your life, whatever the things are that you do. There should be a purpose. Now we go back to the topic, but if you clearly define the purpose, it's very easy to take steps to get there. Let's say, you know, I don't know my way around Guyana, but somebody said, oh, there's this really nice place, such and such. You could, when you go to Guyana, make sure you get, you know, make a visit there. There's a nice waterfall, or some nature beauty scene, or something like that. Then, if I have a very clear goal, then I can find out where that place is, get my GPS, or ask somebody, and get there. But I know the goal. But supposing another somebody says, Guyana is a really nice place, you should go around and see the place. There's some really nice places, especially, but I don't know what they are, I don't know their names, I don't know how to get there. But there's some very nice places. When I was in college, I had a friend that used to just get in his little sports car and go for a ride. And I asked him a couple of times, when you get in your car, where are you going? Just going for a ride. And my reply was, I hope you get there. Just like, you know, see what a spirit moves you. And people go through life that way. Or they may have some material goal. And that's another problem. Because the closer you get to the material goal, the more you find it doesn't satisfy. That's a whole topic. I'll spend 3 minutes on, 4 minutes on that topic. There's, in academia, from the time of post-World War II era, economy, particularly in Japan, Germany, and USA, economy boomed. Boom. And so they had experts doing their research work studying what makes the economy boom and what makes the economy sag. And one of the things that they found, because there was lots of money to do this research, they found that
prosperous a nation is, the less people report being satisfied. Because, just think about it for a moment, the nature of the fuel that propels economy is you're not satisfied. You just need such and such. So work hard, get such and such, and then you'll be satisfied. But such and such doesn't satisfy. In fact, it gives dissatisfaction. They have like all these scholarly ways of describing it, which I won't go into, but at colleges I take the time and go through. This professor says, that professor says, they have, you know, professors are, they have their own terminology, they make up some term, and then they coin the term, and then explain according to the research. It all points to that. So they get a name for themselves. One of them was Professor Enderlein, E-N-D-E-R-L-E-I-N, German name. He was professor at Princeton University. And he did research. He's an economics professor. And 10, 12 years of research. And he came with certain findings, which he very humbly called the Enderlein principle. And the principle is, there's a chart, goes like this. The wealth of people goes like this, boom, boom, boom. And those that report the most as being satisfied goes boom, 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 boom. Now that's very interesting, because to prosper, you should become more satisfied, more happy. But people report about the same or less, while their wealth, and everybody wants, no doubt about it. Everybody wants to prosper. Everyone wants wealth and money and the things that money can buy. There are a few people, but most people want that. And it was offered to them, they would say yes. Or they're chasing after it. And it's elusive. But the happiness is less. What's going on here? Sure, it's the wrong principle. Consumerism, if there's a goal, that my goal is I want to prosper. My New Year's vision is da-da-da-da-da, so I can have so much more money, or have some more things, or go some more places, or something, or read some more books, or get some more knowledge, or something that's out there in the gross or subtle marketplace of things of this world. So, not having a clear sense of goal or having a material sense of goal, neither are going to bring satisfaction. So, next step in this little discussion this morning is, it's New Year's, if you have this tendency or wish or cultural thing that you make a New Year's resolution, that what should that New Year's resolution be? It should be something that assists you getting to your goal. So what's the goal? And so if you listen to Srila Prabhupada's teachings a little bit, it's very clear, abundantly clear, that most people don't know what the goal of life is. In fact, they don't even ask what the goal of life is. They don't have a clue what the goal of life is. It's sense enjoyment of different labels, whatever that goal is. Or another cliche is, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die. You heard that one? Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die. Live today like there's no tomorrow. Same idea. So what's the goal? Enjoy. Enjoy means enjoy the senses. Find happiness through the senses contacting sense objects. So if you prosper, then you have more sense objects and you have more choices. You should enjoy more. Doesn't work that way. So now let's go to someone that has as a goal spiritual progress, progressing on the path to Krishna. Okay, that's a nice goal. Now, who is Krishna? Ask people that you meet from time to time. Try it. What's your conception of God and what's your conception of the soul? See if you have a very clear idea when you speak to people. I've done it. It's amazing that they'll say they have faith in God and belief in God, but what is God and what is the soul? Whoa! It's not clear. And so, good luck getting there. So then we'll go another step, and someone is reading transcendental literature that's coming into cyclic succession. They're reading these nice books, like Arjuna, Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita. It tells very clearly what the goal is. And maybe even we'll go a little step further, someone actually has grasped what the goal is, at least conceptually. Now I'll share something that I think it's okay to do in this audience. I have the experience that many people who are practicing devotees accept Krishna consciousness within their mind, and they don't go beyond that. Meaning, you know, to deeply accept the exclusive shelter of Krishna, factually, and conscientiously apply themselves from their heart and soul to that mission of life as the goal of life. Krishna is my exclusive shelter. Because that's what the teaching is. There's two sentences that I want to, hopefully I'll find right away, in Prabhupada's introduction to Bhagavad Gita that here we go. Two sentences, listen very carefully. Lord Krishna descends specifically to reestablish the real purpose of life when man forgets that purpose. Okay? What's he saying? There's this material world, and you're here in a slice of it, the Dhyana slice, and there's a purpose to life, but people may have forgotten that purpose, what's the goal. So Prabhupada's saying Krishna descends into this world specifically to help reestablish what the purpose of life is for those who have forgotten it. So that's very nice. Even then, out of many, many human beings who awaken. Oh, that's the goal of life. Now, I got it. That's the goal of life. What's the goal of life? To reestablish ourselves in our loving relationship with Krishna eternally, and return to Him in the spiritual world. Live our life that way now, and enter into that eternal spiritual realm after this life. Okay, that's the goal. Even then, out of many, many human beings who awaken, there may be one who actually enters the spirit of understanding his position. And for him, the Bhagavad Gita is spoken. What's that saying? For a number of years, I had the wonderful opportunity of, as a brahmachari, serving Srila Prabhupada by distributing his books. And we went here, there, and all around town, and colleges especially, with one of the favorite places that I like to go. But, you know, all over New York City, Harinam Sankirtan, and Harlem, and the Bronx, and, you know, Queens, and up and down Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, and all around town. And then, you know, in the airports and in shopping centers and, you know, all over America. outside of America. I went to Puerto Rico for a year, distributing books in Puerto Rico. In the airport in Puerto Rico, in San Juan, became legal for book distribution. So, from all those years of experience, it's something that was had become an ingrained part of doing it day after 7 days of the week for so many hours every day. There was a purpose in distributing these books. Of course, ultimately it was that Srila Prabhupada wanted to see them distributed. But there was a reason. It was to help fulfill Krishna's purpose, to help people remember the purpose of life when they've forgotten it. And the understanding was, at least give people the opportunity. Everyone, equal opportunity organization. Does that mean something in here in Guyana? Equal opportunity means we don't discriminate against, you know, this group, this race, religion, that race. Equal opportunity. Men, women, equal opportunity. Everyone has the opportunity. Provide that opportunity. But somewhere out of all those persons, and this was my regular experience, there were at least one to five generally very special persons that were actually looking for this message. They may not even have known the title of it was Bhagavad Gita, but they're looking for this knowledge. And my mission was to give a book to everybody, and especially to find those few special people that were really going to connect. And I'll just take that one step further. Of those that would really connect, some may actually enter into the mood or spirit of that understanding. And for that reason, Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita, and for that reason, I was engaged in his service to those very special souls. Just to be a postal peon, Prabhupada used that phrase, just to deliver the message. You know, there's the letter, it's got, you know, Krishna's name on the return address, and it's got your name on the envelope. Nice postage stamp with a devotee smiling. This is for you. Please take it. And he would sometimes say like that, here, this is for you. Please take it. And they go, what, for me? Yeah. Krishna sent me. I'm the messenger. He goes, this is for you. He's got your name on it. Here's what it says inside. I looked at it. It says, you know, you're to go back to Godhead at the end of this lifetime just by taking shelter of Krishna. I mean, some message. So making a New Year's resolution, ask if you have a clear idea what the goal of your life is, and it's Krishna, to help you get to that position where you're entering into the mood and the spirit of that path to Krishna, becoming a lover of Krishna. When you're a lover, everything is centered around that person whom you love, the object of love. But there's so many, so the next is to make that kind of resolution. I don't really have the resolve because I'm attached to so many other things. Bahusha kavinam tascha. Krishna describes that in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So, bring in the old and ring out the new. Whoops. Bring in the new, not the old. I said it backwards. Because you can't go forward as long as you're attached to the limited and temporary. You can't reach that goal. There's, how does one become very focused or fixed upon the goal? One of the requirements is you let go of the limited and temporary. There's a classic story I'll quickly describe. Once upon a time, there was a devotee. And he had a spiritual master. And he went every day to hear from his spiritual master. He lived outside the village. He lived in the forest. He lived in a little cottage in the forest. And every day he'd go and hear from his spiritual master. And he thought, I am so fortunate because I get to hear every day personally from my spiritual master. And as time went on, he became really excited. He wanted to ask this lifelong question that had been burning in his heart, and he finally got up enough courage to ask the spiritual master that very important question. There's a build-up here. So one morning he went and heard the class, and after the class he asked this question, this burning question. Why is it so difficult to make progress in spiritual life because it's so attractive? Why is it so difficult? And the spiritual master replied, this is a very deep question. I'm going to have to think about it overnight. You come back tomorrow, and I'll give you the answer. So the disciple was thinking, oh, no, I'm so fortunate. My guru is going to ask this wonderful, important question. And tomorrow, I get to hear the answer. So he was so excited, he couldn't even sleep. He just waited for the crack of dawn and took his bath and went out into the on the path into the forest, and his heart was pounding, thinking, I'm going to get the answer to this question. And as he was approaching his guru's cottage, he heard, help! 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 That's Guruji's voice. And he went running, thinking, what happened? I've never seen him in any difficulty before. And he reached the cottage, and there's a clearing in this front of his cottage. And then he saw his spiritual master leaning against the tree with his legs around the tree, his arms on the tree, his head by the side of the tree. And Guruji, what happened? He's pulling him by the arm, pulling him by the waist, and pulling him. Finally, his guru stood up and said, now do you understand? It's so difficult to make progress in spiritual life because you're holding on so tightly to your material attachments. So even if you make a nice New Year's resolution, how often does it last? There was a message that made a New Year's resolution. How many of us? It's not, you know, you don't need to be embarrassed about it. It's a standard program for anishtita bhakti that we make some resolve to improve our spiritual life and it doesn't stick. Or something that we know that we should do without. And we examine it from all different angles, and it's definitely something I should do without, and we make this firm resolve, I'm going to do without this thing. And we still do the same thing. We don't need a show of hands. Anyone's hand can go up because it's standard for unsteady anishtita bhakti, was even the term for it. And there's eight different categories of it by our child. So welcome everybody to, you know, unsteady devotional service, because even if you know what the goal is, to actually enter into the spirit of achieving the goal, it will not happen as long as there's, we are still holding on. We're still taking shelter in all things temporary, or some part of the things temporary. So what to do? That's the problem. Now what's the solution to the problem? Well, Srimad Bhagavatam presents the solution to the problem. The essence of the solution to the problem is by receiving descending mercy through oral reception. Chinbanti Kovidas Tasya Kona Koryat Katarathim. Chinbanti means cut. With sword in hand, intelligent men cut through the binding knots of reactionary work karma by remembering the personality of Godhead. Therefore, he will not pay attention to his message. By hearing, if you want to achieve your New Year's resolution or achieve progress on the path to the goal of life, once you've understood it by reading these authorized literatures, the goal of life is identified, to make the commitment to take a step, a doable step towards that goal, and that will endure. Look at the other side. Those things, those temporary shelters that keep you chained, keep you from remaining resolved. Anartha Pashamam Sakshat Bhakti Yoga Mahade. This Canto 1, Chapter 2. If you could just learn that Canto 1, Chapter 2, you have enough information to go back to Godhead. It's read it again and again and again and again and again and again. And it's the essence of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam is packed in that one chapter, because there are questions that are essence questions asked by the sages of Naimisharanya, and Sukha Goswami gives sequential answers laying out the whole process of devotional service, how it works. And the rest of the Bhagavatam is expanding on that. And the expansion is also very nice, but the essence is right there. To effectively make a New Year's resolution or any resolution, any resolve to go towards the goal and more clearly understand the goal and develop affinity for and attachment for and love for God, the goal, simultaneously there needs to be this cutting or letting go of false shelters. And we all have them, because we're not impersonal, we're persons. And to the extent that there's full shelter in Krishna, they fade. But to the extent there isn't full shelter in Krishna, we have them. We all have them. It's not something to be embarrassed about, it's just reality. We have false shelters. They should be cut with the transcendental weapon of hearing, receiving not only knowledge, not only information, but a purified condition of heart so that we can act upon that knowledge and consistently from the heart. Act upon the knowledge knowing it's going and feeling that it's bringing me closer to Krishna. It's bringing me closer to the goal. I'll end with the next thought. Just this morning, we're reading in the fourth canto, Srimad Bhagavatam, the song sung by Lord Shiva. The scene is, or the storyline, is there are Pachini Bhani, there's a king, who has asked his sons to assist him. It's very, very, very early in the creation, and he has a service to do. He used to produce, give good population to the earth. So he asks his sons to assist him. And their answer? Yes, sir. And to do that, the first thing they do is they go to purify themselves, because you can't produce good offspring if you're not in a pure state of consciousness. And that's their service, not just good offspring, but good offspring. Populate the planet with good offspring. So they go to purify themselves. And it's a very serious commitment. It's Satya Yuga, so duration of life is much longer, but for 10,000 years, they're going to meditate. They're not just going to meditate, they're going to meditate underwater, so they don't get disturbed by anything. I mean, we can't do something like that. How long can you hold your breath underwater? So they were mystics. And they knew how to do this. And as they were just getting ready to enter into the water, Lord Shiva came out of the water. blessing them, saying, "You've pleased me very much by your nice mood of submission to your father and your ability to cooperate nicely with one another. And you've pleased me so much, I want to give you some prayers where, while you're purifying yourself, you can fix your mind completely on the personality of Godhead. In fact, they're prayers or stotras that I myself meditate upon." And then, what we were reading this morning is that when such a state, when Vasudeva or Krishna becomes fixed in one's consciousness, everything desirable can be achieved. Like Dhruva Maharaj. What did Dhruva Maharaj want? He had a desire. He wanted a kingdom. And why did he want a kingdom? He wanted to get back at his stepmother for treating him so nasty. I have a nickname. Her name was Suniti. And I call her Sunasti. Very nasty. She was so nasty. Dhruva turned to his father and asked his father for shelter, and his father said nothing because he was attached to Sunasti. So he said nothing. So the boy was double hurt. He just left. "I want a kingdom." It was like, you know, he was materially driven. His mother, it was actually Suruchi, just the stepmother. His mother, Suniti, said, "I can't help you. I can't help you because your father has so much affection for your stepmother. Although I am the older queen, she's the younger queen. He has so much affection for her. He doesn't even care for me. That's why I'm way over here instead of in the palace, because he doesn't care for me. I can't influence Uttanapada at all. I'm very sorry. I'm just being honest. I feel." Then Dhruva was saying, "Then who can? Where do I go? I want a kingdom." So, Lord Vishnu, if you receive the favor of Lord Vishnu, you can achieve anything. Dhruva thought and said, "Very well. Where do I find Lord Vishnu? I want to go find Lord Vishnu." He said, I'm just a queen in the palace. I don't know all these things, but I understand the sages. They go to the forest and somehow they find Lord Vishnu." He said, "Very well, I'm going to the forest." He started wandering around the forest looking for Vishnu. He saw lots of trees and animals and birds and all kinds of things. And he didn't find Vishnu. But he didn't know how to find Vishnu. But he wanted to find Vishnu. So Narada heard that the son of King Uttanapada, this little boy, 6 years old, he's gone to the forest to find Vishnu. So Narada went to the forest to look for Dhruva. And Narada found him. And when Dhruva saw Narada, he knew who was Narada. I mean, he had his nice veena and everything. He knew it was Narada. Just a small boy. "Oh, Naradaji, please tell me how I can find Vishnu." And Narada said, "You're just a small boy. To achieve Vishnu, even great yogis and ascetics and tapasvis and very learned persons, they can spend years and years and years and years and still not find them. You're just a small boy. Why don't you go back to the palace? When you grow up, you can come out again." Guru was silent. The answer was, "No, I'm not going back to the palace. I want to find Vishnu." In several ways, Narada examined the determination of Dhruva. Dhruva was very determined. Very determined. Because he was materially driven, he wanted that New Year's resolution. He was fixed. to not even realize. He's very determined. Unquestionably determined. Very well, I'll give you the means by which you can achieve the Vishnu. And he gave this mantra. What was his mantra? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. And Dhruva regularly was chanting this mantra along with performing the means for the age, which was meditation. Only it was a very unique kind of meditation and very severe austerity. You know what his austerity was? To get his New Year's resolution fulfilled? He realized Lord Vishnu in 6 months. The first month, try it. I don't recommend you try it. Every third day, he fast for 3 days. At the evening of the third day, he ate some fruits, and they were a very special kind of fruits. They're kapita fruits. It's described in the Bhagavatam. They're so hard that only monkeys can eat them. You hit them with a hammer, you break the hammer. Teeth can't eat them. But he would soak them and then eat kapita fruits. Fruits and berries every third day. And then the second month, that was too much sense gratification, so every 6 days he gave up the fruits and berries and he ate dry leaves that fell to the ground. Not even like, you know, leaves off of trees, just what's lying on the ground, rotting or decaying. And that was every 6 days he ate some dry leaves, yummy. Then the third month is every 9 days and he drank some water. Where do you go after that? On the fourth month, every 12 days, he took a breath of air. And every 12 days, he would take another breath of air. He was a yogi. You can't imitate. The fifth month, he stood on one leg. And every 15 days, he took a breath of air. Try it. Stand on one leg for a while. Not right now, but stand on one leg. I mean, it was extreme. And it was so extreme that the flow of air throughout the whole universe was being suffocated because he was so powerful. The demigods were they were choked. They couldn't breathe. They went to Lord Vishnu and said, help. We can't breathe. What's going on? Lord Vishnu said, don't worry. It's just a little six-year-old boy off in the forest who's doing some yoga. I'll go take care of it. Don't worry. You can go back to your heavenly kingdom. Okay. He became as heavy as the Lord himself. That's pretty heavy because the whole earth planet where that one foot was pressing, it got indented. It was pressed down by his universal weight. He became very powerful. But in the course of becoming so powerful, what happened with that I Want a Kingdom program? It was gone. It was gone. His New Year's resolution was gone. But his concentration wasn't gone because it started mixed, but then it became just one thing. And that one thing was achieved by Vishnu. And then, while in trance, the form of Lord Vishnu appeared in his heart. And his body began to tremble. Tears were streaming from his eyes while he was standing on one foot. And his hair standing on end and seeing Lord Vishnu. And then all of a sudden, he disappeared. He was shocked. So he opened his eyes and looked around and, where did Lord Vishnu go? Mary saw him standing right in front of him. But every Bhagavishnu he saw within the heart was standing in front of him, smiling. Dhruva couldn't speak. He wanted to speak, he wanted to offer prayers, but his voice was choked. So Lord Vishnu extended his conch shell and touched Dhruva upon the head. And immediately, ecstatic love of Godhead erupted and he was empowered to speak beautiful prayers. The prayers of Dhruva Maharaj are very, very wonderful. What fulfilled his desire was the mercy of his spiritual master. He attributes that later to Narada. Because of his deep gratitude to Narada. Narada could have just dismissed him, saying, "You silly boy, go away." He didn't just immediately tell the little boy, "Here's how you do it." Also, he examined him and he saw he was very determined. So he gave him the means to let go of material shelters. This is the main thing I wanted to speak about, actually, not just New Year's resolutions. If you want to become resolved in achieving spiritual progress of some degree, you have to let go of material shelters. And the process of taking shelter of the instructions of bona fide scriptures or the instructions of the spiritual master found in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, it'll get you there. It's high test. It's rocket fuel. It will carry you there if you take shelter, just as those two sentences that I read from the introduction. Krishna comes specifically and delivers his message specifically for those who are prepared to enter into the spirit of the understanding of what the goal of life is. It will carry us. Krishna will carry us to that destination. And whatever it is, if it's a kingdom like Dhruva, and it was a big kingdom, he got it. Or the Prajapas who become Prajapatis, they got it. More than they got it, they also saw Lord Vishnu, as did Dhruva, because they took shelter of the instructions that they received from Lord Shiva. They achieve the spiritual destination. And in the course of achieving the spiritual destination, the worldly things were also achieved, but things were no longer their shelter. Simply service to the Lord became their shelter. So what's the conclusion? Concluding remarks. To resolve to go further towards the goal, you need to know what the goal is. You need to know the means to reach the goal. And you need to take shelter of the means to reach the goal. But you also need to let go of false shelters. But chindanti kovidas tasya. It's not passive. The process of hearing can remove those false shelters, but it's not a passive process. Like standing in a shower. You don't just stand in a shower. You do this, right? You're not just passive. The process of devotional service is also by hearing. It's an active process. It's take those messages that you've heard and bring them into your heart. Shindanti, Gayanti, Gunanti Sadavaha. Verse from the Bhagavatam. Shundanti is to hear. Dayanti is to speak. So you hear and chant. Hear and chant it. And the next step is Grinanti. You bring them within your heart. You incorporate them within your very soul, your very existence. And you live them. You live the message of the scripture. And your spiritual progress just happens. Very naturally. So it's not passive, it's active, and progress will come. And those things that are the false shelters of life, you'll see them as false shelters, and you'll have the spiritual strength to let go. Hare Krishna. Any questions or comments somebody would like to raise? Yeah?
Hare Krishna. I was thinking that, isn't it contradictory to yoga and sanyasa in this world? We are working with the idea to achieve that we will be prosperous. That, as you were quoting and explaining that, days ago like this, and this terrified, and days ago like this, I'm thinking that it sounds a little contradictory that, it's a little different from our understanding. And the other part of my, that's one part. The other part of my question is, what it will take for us to understand it in this way that you're explaining.
Well, I could just expand on the first part. It's not just, Professor Engelheim. It's hundreds and hundreds of scholars working together in teams have come to the same conclusion. Here's another one, and I don't remember his name. At Swarthmore College, there's another professor who wrote a book, Tyranny of Choice. Tyranny of Choice says, his premise is that in America, where he's the professor, people value freedom, the land of the home and the brave, or something like that. So Americans value their freedom, and freedom means you have choices. And if you have wealth, then you can make more choices. Plus, you have some freedom to make choices. So then you should be happy. But his studies show that the more there's choice, the more one suffers. But the danger of it's not a contradiction, it's the very nature of the driving principle that makes consumer economics go, is that you're not satisfied. The goal is not satisfaction, because you can't get satisfied, because consumer economics means you always have to have more. And the more you have, that doesn't satisfy, you have to have more. There's never a point, the goal is not satisfaction, it's driven by dissatisfaction. It fosters dissatisfaction. Become successful, you become dissatisfied. Remain unsuccessful, you're also dissatisfied. If you win, you lose, and if you lose, you lose. It's the material program, it's the sucker punch. It's the nature of yehi sam sparsha jab bhoga dukha yo naya evate, in the language of Bhagavad Gita. Promise is bhoga, I enjoy. And what do I enjoy? Sam sparsha jab, contact of the senses with the object of the senses. Yehi sam sparsha jab bhoga dukkha yonaya evate. I was expecting happiness and I got punched with suffering. It's not only the nature of consumer economics, it's the nature of material happiness. The contradiction is in the promise or the expectation of happiness through sense gratification that doesn't produce happiness. It produces dukkha. And not only one time, birth after birth. It's built into the system by design. And we're buying the product and calling it happiness. And just with the mindset, I just have to do it in a more clever, expert way. I need more of this, a little less of that, and get some more, adjust things. Forever materially adjusting, and it never happens. it's say the same thing in a very different way. People sometimes ask this question, and there's different versions of the same question. God is all good, and God is all powerful. So why did God create a world in which there's so much suffering? Because God is all good, and He's all powerful. He could have made it different. Why did He make it so that there's so much suffering? Now, indirectly, it's like He blew it. In fact, there's a book which makes that claim. As a Jewish rabbi wrote a book saying that, you know, God meant well, but He's made a mistake. That's the premise of his whole book. My bad things happen to good people. That's his premise. God's nice. He meant well. He just made a mistake. So we can forgive him because he made a mistake. And therefore, it's only for that reason that bad things happen to good people. And that's not a good reason to be not good. You should continue to be good, and if bad things happen, don't worry about it. Anyway, and this is just a sec. Let me just finish this. So how it fits with Krishna consciousness, which is the second part of your question. Chindanti Kovidas Tasya, armed with the sword of knowledge, then, well, the sucker punch, if the signal says, come and enjoy, you know, we don't fall for the sucker punch. We don't go for the sense gratification knowing that it's going to only bring misery. But we, so, na sate vijite bhavo, na bhavo vijite sataha. That's our solution. We withdraw our investment of consciousness in asat and place our consciousness in sat. Twanyo sattva-darshadi, following the guidance of tattva-darshis. They know this to be a fact. They're guiding us. We just follow the advice of the tattva-darshis so we don't get the sucker punch. There's a dukkha when the expectation is super. And that's what these professors that are studying consumer economics, that's all that they're saying in Bhagavad Gita language. That's what they're concluding. So we don't have to go through all that. We can just take shelter Krishna's message in Bhagavad Gita. Or you can go through all that, learn from those people, but it's only something that Krishna has already said. And then, you know, it's not just one group of researchers. Dozens. All concluding the same thing. You know, in very sophisticated, polished language, it's the same thing. They just don't know how to, you know, they don't know the alternative. So the alternative is take shelter of Krishna. And when you take shelter, I explained, when you take shelter of Krishna, like Dhruva, or like the Pajetas, you may have the kingdom, you may have the good progeny, but it's not a position of false shelter. It's simply a service, or Lord Brahma, creating the universe, or whatever our program is, whatever our life is. We have something that built in within the conditioning that we've given. I'm doing this because I'm expecting it's going to bring me happiness. Now we're devoting, we're here, wait a minute. It's got a sucker punch built into it. So I'm not going to take shelter of it as a means of happiness. I'll perform my activity according to the codes of Dharma and fix my consciousness upon Krishna by the means of hearing and chanting. And thus, by hearing and chanting, my heart will become cleansed of this very persistent tendency to try to be the enjoyer of temporary things. I take shelter of the process of hearing and chanting because I have faith in it, and faith in the object, Krishna. That's our response to the very strong tendency of this world to chase after illusory happiness. Yes, sir. Hare Krishna. We got it. I've been asked the same question. More than once even. But I'll read directly what Krishna's answer is with physical symptoms. Chapter 14 is about the modes of material nature. Krishna describes the three modes and starts by saying everyone is influenced by those three modes. But there's a category of persons who are not influenced by the three modes. Those are liberated souls, and they're very rare. So Arjuna inquired, "Oh my dear Lord, by which symptoms is one to know who is transcendental for these modes? What is his behavior? And how does he transcend the modes of nature?" The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "O son of Pandu, he who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they are present, or long for them when they disappear, who is unwavering and undisturbed through all these reactions of the material qualities remaining neutral and transcendental, knowing that the modes alone are active, who is situated in the self and regards alike happiness and distress." Even that phrase alone. I mean, happiness is happiness. And distress is distress. I mean, the very nature of it is, it appears to be something that this is nice and that's not nice. But how can it be neutral? This is nice. Makes me happy. That's transcendental. Who looks upon a lump of earth, a stone and a piece of gold with an equal eye, is equal toward the desirable and the undesirable. That's the same like happiness and distress. They can still distinguish, this is undesirable. Let's say, on the way to Brebis, I've noticed each time that there's a certain area where the smell starts to come up, and it's a brewery where they make rum. And other stuff like that. And you're just like, okay. But, just keep chanting. I didn't choose to live in that neighborhood, but, we just keep moving and etc. Then we pass a nice lotus garden. That was very nice. They just, you can still see distinctions. The transcendentalist is not unconscious, but while conscious is not finding shelter in those things. And there's this steadiness of consciousness and behavior. Who is steady, situated equally well in praise and blame, honor and dishonor, who treats alike both friend and enemy, and who has renounced all material activity, such a person is said to have transcended the modes of nature. Then how does he, what is his behavior? First is, what are the symptoms, then what is his behavior? When he engages in full devotional service and standing in all circumstances, at once transcends the modes of material nature, and thus comes to the level of Brahman. You have something to follow up after that?
What are the physical expressions of this?
There's different physical expressions. So something that you can see.
From his body, is there some physical expression that you can see that this individual? Earlier you described that individual shed tears. Is this one of the
No. No. An elevated Vaishnava will restrain that. And this is our teaching. An elevated Vaishnava does not want to, and therefore doesn't, exhibit such symptoms in public, because the public will not understand it properly. So they don't. They restrain those symptoms. Shivering of the body, tears coming. But this is Dhruva off in the forest. He's not exhibiting, there's nobody around except the personality of Godhead. It's not one aspires for those things, nor are those physical symptoms that one demonstrating. Because, in fact, there are experts who have trained themselves to be able to shiver and have tears come from their eyes at the right prompt. I've seen it. And that's not, so that particular physical symptom is not the physical symptom to examine. But there's someone who's always engaged in devotional service, undeviatingly.
But then Lord Chaitanya gives no symptoms.
Yes, and he tried to restrain them. When he met with Ramananda Roy on the bank of the river Kaveri, just to be in Ramananda Roy's association, they were experiencing ecstatic symptoms. He checked those symptoms and said, let us not carry on this conversation just now. There are too many soldiers around. I'll meet you later and we can have our discussions. Because worldly people won't understand those things. There are circumstances where, at Rath Yatra, for example, Lord Chaitanya exhibited such symptoms. So it's not like a universal, he never did, but in principle, he restrained, he checked those symptoms. And that's a very highly elevated state.
I would think that these symptoms would be spontaneous in such an individual, even though you may try to restrain them. But will the force of this loving experience create those symptoms like
manipulation? Yes. That's right. They would two things. What you said is true and what I said is true. They don't get counsel each other. They come spontaneously, it's not by practice. They come spontaneously. Jubilation of the heart brings about those bodily transformations spontaneously. It's true. And he checks them, that's also true. Because an elevated soul has service to do. And if that interferes with their service, they check them. And their service is to get the people of the world to try to, you know, cry and tremble. Rather, these are the symptoms that the great soul is inducing others to come to by their example, that they're constantly engaged in service to Krishna, unflinchingly, every moment. That will bring such ecstasies, which they will then try to check. The example in Nectar Devotion is given of the cowherd boy, Garuka. You know this example? He was, sometimes when the cowherd boys would be herding the calves in the forest, Krishna would become tired. Now Krishna is the personality of God, it doesn't become tired. But Krishna would become tired. They would lie down. And Dhruva was ready. He had a nice peacock fan. And he was fanning Krishna. With such love that his body began erupting in ecstatic symptoms. It was interfering with his fanning of Krishna. So he would check the symptoms. But he wanted his happiness was in the service. His objective was please Krishna's senses, not experience ecstasy. And he was interfering with his family, so he checked symptoms. That's Dharuka, the cowherd boy. And then there's the great Acharya, who's teaching the world the science of devotion to Krishna. What they want the people in general to understand is the principles of devotion, exclusive devotion. Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam. Bhakti Uchate, that's what they want.
So by example, he shows. And by example, symptoms will come, and he checks the symptoms because he wants to show Rishikesh or Rishikesh is saving him. Not get adoration from the public. Oh, just see, Guruji has these nice symptoms. And then people will imitate. As Prabhupada would say, and this is going on. I'll tell a little story. Yeah, I got just in Mayapur, when festival, I think it was 1975 in Mayapur, the Purpanima festival, around 10 o'clock in the morning, so after the morning program, and everyone had breakfast, and everyone's like, you know, peaceful and just chanting. So I was chanting in the garden outside the temple, where the lotus building. It was the only building then at that time. And there was a little park along the side. I was chanting japa in the park. And I heard in the temple room, there was a kirtan. And I, from where I was standing, I saw Prabhupada come out of his room, come to the balcony, and shout loud enough that I could hear it down, you know, on the ground floor, for his servant and his secretary both to go in the temple room and kick the people out of the temple room that were having kirtan. So they went running down, you know, big American guys running down the stairs, threw the people out of the room. Because sure enough, about 10 minutes into the program, they sat down on the temple room floor and, like, you know, played the mridanga and played the little harmonium, and then they got up and started dancing, and then they started rolling on the ground, and, you know, they were in ecstasy, rolling on the ground, shivering and crying and rolling on the ground. So then when these two big strong football player-sized Americans picked them up and tossed them out, you know, on the way out to the front gate, they're smoking the bidis, immediately after their ecstasy. Just by the sound of the kirtan, Prabhupada could tell up from the second floor what was going on. That was an important lesson for me. I couldn't tell just by the sound of the kirtan. Prabhupada could tell just by the sound of the kirtan. It was imitation kirtan and imitation ecstasy. And then Prabhupada ordered whole 24-hour kirtan in the temple room just to purify the place because it's become contaminated. So symptoms alone don't demonstrate spiritual elevation. Those kinds, those particular kinds of symptoms, they can be feigned and misguided in people. Follow the teaching of Bhagavad Gita and don't look for shivering and tears in the eyes. The symptoms are right here. Arjuna's question, Krishna's answer. Follow it.
Yeah, but Krishna says take shelter of someone who is a guru or a spiritual master. How can we recognize that spiritual master?
You asked that question earlier and the answer doesn't change. They're demonstrating their attachment to Krishna by those symptoms that they just mentioned. Bacho vegam, manasa krodha vegam, jiva vegam, udara pasta vegam is a verse in Nectar of Instruction. Symptoms by which one could understand a person who's gone beyond the urges or the pushings of the material energy. They're situated transcendentally. Read Nectar of Instruction, text number 1, and read these verses from chapter 14, and if you still don't get it, speak to Prabhupada Dave, and I'm going to call on Vedavid next. Vedavid?
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
So,
project your voice.
Yes.
mentioned in the scripture how you can distinguish between false symptoms and real symptoms.
False and real?
Symptoms.
Emotion.
Okay. For instance, the tears flowing from one's eyes. If it's, Prabhupada mentioned, if it's warm, we know the person is in anxiety and not in ecstasy. And if the tears is cool, it's partial ecstasy. So most of the time, all of these big symptoms, it's warm coming from. So you can check that.
Okay. There's other things too.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's another level of symptom. But it doesn't mean if someone doesn't have cold tears coming from their eyes, they're not a qualified person. You follow? The standard is here. You just read it. Anything else? Anything from the ladies' side? Okay. What are the material things that we should let go? We know that Krishna knows, but we don't know. That's the question? You must have, as one of your favorite verses, the prayers of Queen Kunti, right? Prayers of Queen Kunti, chapter 8, canto 1. She answers, and Prabhupada explains in the purport. She prays to Krishna to remove the material portion of her attachments for the Pandavas and the Vrishnis. You familiar? What is that? That's sincere. Krishna helps.
that sincere devotee achieve shelter of him. But then there are things that we still hold on to. There are things that we can easily let go of. Boom, they're all gone. And then there's things that we hold on to, and that where we get stuck, where our progress is impeded. So when that stage comes, we can pray to Krishna. Let the material portion of my service be taken away. Please kindly take that away. Dear Lord Hari, please take it away. And put in its place exclusively the spiritual attachment, the spiritual affinity. So you can apply that principle wherever you're, in Kunti's case, wherever your attachments are, you apply it. In Kunti's case, it was with her sons and her father's relation. So Prabhupada explains this in the purport. A woman has two families, her father's family, for whom she feels some affinity, and her own children and family, for whom she feels affinity. And here's the situation. Krishna is just now leaving Hastinapur to go to Dwarka. So when he goes to Dwarka, her father's family is going to be with Krishna, so she's happy for her father's family. But her son's family, she knows they're going to be feeling great separation. Her sons are going to feel Krishna's separation. So if Krishna's there, there's pain. Krishna's here, there's pain. And why is that pain? It's just due to material identification with the body. So please remove that material identification with the body. And let the identification just be exclusively on the platform of the soul. So, here's how Prabhupada writes about it in the purport. For the Pandavas and the Vrishnis is not out of the range of devotional service. Kunti certified okay. Because the service of the Lord and the service of the devotees are identical. And her family members, her sons, are devotees of the Lord. And on her father's side, they're devotees of the Lord. So it's certified. She's A-okay. Sometimes service to the devotee is more valuable than service to the Lord. But here, the affection of Kunti Devi for the Pandavas and Vrishni was due to family link. The tie, not just because they're devotees, but these are my sons and this is my father and his family. The tie of affection in terms of material relation is the relation of Maya, because the relations of the body or the mind are due to the influence of the external energy. But relations of the soul established in relation with the Supreme Soul are factual relations. When Kunti wanted to cut off the family relation, she meant to cut off the relation of the skin or the material portion. The skin relation is the cause of material bondage. But the relation of the soul is the cause of freedom. The relation of the soul to the soul can be established by the medium, via medium of the relationship with super soul. So, pray to Krishna to leave the spiritual portion, taking away the material portion, even if you can't clearly discern, you know, what part is the material portion. Krishna knows. If you call feelingly
to Krishna, to please give me shelter, please take away all my false shelters, or the material portion of those shelters that are false shelters. That looks like it's a signal. Time's up.
Okay. Okay? All right?
Okay, thank you very much. It's time for something else to happen now. What's something else? What's next? I'm finished. Aarti. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.